Ready to dive in? Welcome to Adventures in Truth Podcast. Every episode, we explore, expand, and evolve our understanding of the truths we encounter and experience in our human quest for clarity and exponential growth. And now welcome your hosts, Dr. Jeffrey Smith and Jim Case. Welcome to Adventures in Truth Podcast.
Hello, everyone. Dr. Jeff here with Jim Case in another weekly episode of Adventures in Truth Podcast. Totally up for this one, as all of them, actually. Yeah. How are you today, Jim?
Good afternoon, Dr. Jeff. I am good. Thank you. Been busy at it and excited to see where our adventure takes us today.
Righto. Are you ready to talk about love?
Always.
All righty. Before we started today, I was giggling a little bit because I had, for some reason, I had this song going around in my head, What is Love? That might be the title of the song, What is Love? And then there's a lyric that comes right after
Baby
that.
Baby, don't hurt me.
Yeah, exactly.
Baby, so it's like, don't hurt me, don't hurt me.
There you go, Jim. Go for it. So love and hurt. Wow, do those go together? Apparently they do. So,
or do they?
Well, yeah, I guess that's what we'll explore in our adventure today.
True.
But at least for that song artist, they did, and it became very popular, which means it got a lot of votes, a lot of buys, and clearly it resonated with enough people that that seems to be the experience.
Yeah, as well, you're it's got a good going through all and that. It's a catchy song. And
well, it's funny that you and I didn't talk about that song before our podcast, but as soon as I said it, you got it, and then it was right there in your head. So,
yep, and I can hear it now.
So let's explore whether or not that's a truth or whether that's a lie and a fabrication as we're really just loving this opportunity to pick each other's brains and share the stuff that we come up with our audience of trying to understand ourselves better through what we believe and what we're calling truth and what we thought was truth that may not be that we can set ourselves free from. So love, my goodness. Lots of different words for describing what love is and what it isn't. Mm-hmm. One of the things I remember in grad school, one of my professors talked about snow being a word to describe frozen water in that state where, you know, falls from the air or whatever. But what wasn't known by most of us in the class is that the Eskimos have 32 different words for snow. Snow's the big frozen ice, frozen water, but there are 32 different types of snow to the Eskimos. And you might say, why? Well, because they're kind of like in it a lot. So the one word snow would not capture enough of a description for them to just say, oh, what's the state of the snow? Or did you notice it snowed today? Or gosh, we got more snow coming. It was so important that they had 32 different ways of describing something that they were doing and living and experiencing all the time.
It's so interesting that you brought that up because since we've moved here, obviously, Michael's never been in the snow, and it's been a long, long time for me. And one of the things that he experiences and has been experiencing is how different every snowstorm is, depending on the level of moisture, depending on how dry it is, depending on how windy it is, depending on it. Just it's fascinating and it's interesting because it makes sense that there would be that many different, you know, there's the kind of snow that when it snows, it sticks to everything. There's the kind of snow that snows, it sticks to nothing. There's, you know, it's just amazing. It's the kind of snow you go out to shovel it and it weighs 25 pounds per shovel. and there's other snow mm-hmm. that you go to shovel it, you can't pick it up because it's like fine dust and it just blows every direction, you know? Yeah. So that's so cool. So cool. Anyway, I just thought it was a great correlation.
Yeah. Yeah. It's perhaps you moving to Denver with not much definition or experience with the different types of snow would be similar to maybe some of our listeners today diving into this topic on love without yeah. having heard of the different ways of describing it and experiencing it before. So I'm sure there are more than four, but there are at least four types of love that I'm familiar with talking about and trying to explain. And then there are love languages, so we can talk about that as well. So we'll get into just starting out with categories of love. And one of the categories would be a parental type of love. And that would be the type that it's unconditional. And it's like, no matter what your kid does, you always, you accept them. And an example would be even Jeffrey Dahmer's mother on the witness stand said, but he was such a good boy. He really shouldn't be put to death. You know, he was a good boy. So she was in it to the end, trying to love and support her son despite the things that he had done to get himself where he got himself. So this unconditional type of love would be what would be called an agape. You know, there's a term for it, a Greek or Hebrew. I think it might be Hebrew word that describes this undying, unending, unconditional, positive expression of I accept you regardless of how you show up. And not many of us are able to love at that level. So I kind of started with one that's most difficult. Another type is another foreign word. We have a city named after it. The city of Philadelphia is referred to as the city of brotherly love. Mm-hmm. And the root word for that is phileo. And that is also, it's a brotherly, sisterly, again, it's either Greek or Hebrew, origin of that word, that I love you as a brother or a sister, which is different than a parent to a child. It's more friendly, but yet it's familial in that, you know, we say that blood is thicker than water and, you know, that sort of thing, that it's family and you love with a devotion and an acceptance and a tolerance and a persistence that goes beyond love of just a friendship type of a love, a companionship or a positive regard type of love. So we've got parental love and we've got brotherly sisterly love.
Mm-hmm.
Another category would be eros, from which we get the word erotic from. And this would be the Cupid type of love or the Valentine's type of love, a romance, sexual, intimate type of a love. And, you know, our social medias and media do a great job of promoting that type of love, really more so than the other two that I've mentioned before.
Mm.
And I think that's where a lot of people, when you say, I've fallen in love, that's the version that comes up for most people in their mind is a love that has romance, passion, sexual energy tied to it. Okay. And then there's just a platonic type of love that has no, you know, this is again more of, it's less than brotherly, sisterly, but it's still a level of love, but it doesn't involve a sexual expression to it. So those are the four categories, any four primary categories that different books and tapes and authors and teachers describe. Any thoughts about that, that we add another one or just have some dialogue about those four categories? What? That sounds like om. Are you meditating?
Yeah. Well, I need to be. Yeah, my response is, uh, I'm not even sure where to go with this. I mean, I have like a bunch of thoughts, but it's interesting that we're choosing to start this in categorizing love in the scales of the human experience, meaning that we're defining it against the category. No, we're defining it against the people that we love in what form that shows up in. And to me, that's ultimately why we are where we are as human beings.
Mm-hmm.
Because love has nothing to do with any of that in my perspective. So I'm happy to go here because I think it's important to clarify this or define it in ways that people really grasp and understand and can relate to, ultimately to blow it up because it's nonsensical to me.
Well, that's what we always do, Jim.
I know.
We put something out there. We try to talk about it the best way we can that's relatable to other people. And then we blow it the hell up and laugh and giggle and discover something in the process.
Exactly.
So here we go again.
Yeah, because it's funny because you were giving categories and I'm like, okay, there's unconditional and there's conditional.
Right.
There's unconditional and there's conditional.
Yep.
All of the categories are conditional. Depends on who it is. Depends on what relationship they have to me. Depends on things that really have no bearing on whether you love or don't love. It's funny. We've talked about, if you remember way back when, we talked about capital T truth and small t truth. And mm-hmm. I think we have the same conversation coming about capital L love and small L love.
Sure.
there is the projection of love that the personality loves to play in. And then there's the experience of love, which is something greater than you or I or individually.
Yeah.
Again, from my perspective.
Somewhere toward the end of our podcast, I'm sure that we'll be able to clean all this up and summarize it in a way that we learned something and be able to share it with everybody else as well.
Yeah.
And so maybe these categories are, because I agree with you, there's either love or there isn't love, and we could call that conditional or unconditional.
So what are the structure that you're bringing forward? I'm assuming is somewhat of a foundational thing in psychology. Or in psychiatry, in the teaching of that stuff, or well,
yeah, you heard me mention Greek and Hebrew, so primarily that's straight out of the good book.
Oh.
These descriptions or categories of love. And it's using it more as a verb as in terms of how we do it. Because you would love your sister differently than you would love your wife or your husband or anybody else. You would the way that you do it is kind of how I was describing these categories as more of a application of love. Maybe that would be a better way than calling it a category. But anyway, that was just a place to start.
And it's a good place to start because it jumps right into the middle of all of the paradigms and the illusions and the constructs that we have about how that all is, you know, even as you were just talking about, I love this person, a specific, you know, I love my sister different than I love my, and in my head, I'm going, why? I'm like, I understand what you're saying, but in my head, I'm like going, okay, that's not love. That's not love.
Well, I've told you that I love you and I've heard you say, you love me.
Yes.
But when you tell Michael you love him, I'm pretty sure that means something different.
Only to the degree. How do I clarify that? It is, to me, it's not different. It's depth. So what I mean by that is I've been in relationship with Michael for 10 plus years. So the love is a consistent experience that I try to screw with pretty regularly if I can try to figure it out, you know. but it's a consistent experience that has grown in depth over time. My relationship with you is shorter term, so the depth mm-hmm. isn't there, but the expression, the energy is no different. There are no conditions for me about how I love you. I just love you. It isn't because you this, you that, there is a resonance between us. There is a connection and a depth that continues to grow between us, even though we're not even in the same place.
Right.
Because of the work we're doing together and understanding one another and going deeper into that experience. So the bandwidth of love grows, and I don't have to do anything for that. I don't have to manufacture that. It's a natural experience of allowing oneself to become more vulnerable and more connected and more aligned as you move forward. So the only difference I see is the depth of it, not the content of it. Does that make sense?
Right. So let's say that love involved, that unconditional love involved all four categories at its highest, most involved level.
Right.
The love you and I have would be love minus, in that it doesn't involve the Eros.
Correct.
Which I think is healthy for people to, when they're using the word love, because we toss it around all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Love you, man. You know, just love that shit. And it's, you know, almost, I don't know if the F word gets used more. I probably does than the L word, which is kind of interesting.
Or even better, I fucking love it.
There you go. That was really cool. That just flowed right on out. So since we're on that topic, we've previously discussed how we've come up with words that don't exist to describe. We come up with words that describe an experience of things that don't really exist, such as cold and such as dark. Mm-hmm. Right? So just once again, for people who didn't hear these previous podcasts, we'll run through this really quickly, that cold truly does not exist. It's simply the absence of heat.
Yeah.
And dark truly does not exist. It's an experience that we have when we cannot see. We call it dark. Absolutely. But that doesn't mean there's no light there. That just means our eyes aren't sophisticated to see the limited amount of light that's truly there. But the only way to create dark is to remove light. So there's only light. And in Marianne Williamson's book, Return to Love, I don't know, she certainly wasn't the first one to come up with the concept, but she popularized this idea as there is only love.
Mm-hmm.
So if there is only love, just like there is only heat and there is only light, it's in the absence of love that we come up with these other experiences. And if you go to the other extreme, if you have love on one end of a continuum, the other end of the continuum would be fear. And because we know that fear isn't real, it's false evidence appearing real. Fear is not real. Danger is real. You feel the feeling of fear in the presence of danger. But when danger is not present, people still are afraid because they're making things up in their mind that aren't actually happening. And that's in the absence of love. So we get to fear only in the absence of love, the same way you get to dark and cold in the absence of heat and light.
Yeah, that was something I wanted to clarify, because you were saying at one end of the spectrum is love, the other is fear, and I would tend to argue that and say no, it's absence of love, and within the context of absence of love is all of the stuff that exists on the lower end of the emotional tone scale, because you have removed yourself from your alignment, and so you've left a doorway open for all of that to take over your consciousness and your field. So,
right. Yeah,
but you came back around to that. So I was just wanting to make sure that there was a clarity there.
One of the examples I like to use when I'm talking about this in my practice is if you went to the zoo one day and you're walking around the zoo and somehow the tiger got out and there was pandemonium and chaos and violence and blood and screaming and everything, you would remember that event very unpleasantly if you survived it. That would be danger. A tiger out at the zoo is undeniable danger.
Mm-hmm.
We're not talking about a docile, really old, friendly tiger that's used to people petting it.
Right.
So the next time you go to the zoo, you have these elements present. You are there. The zoo is there. The tiger is there. And all of a sudden, you go into a state of fear because you have three of the four elements present. You, the zoo, the tiger. But the fourth element that's not present is the loose tiger. But our mind will begin to feel fear with three of the four ingredients present. Even though it's not happening, you will feel anxious. You'll feel worried. You'll feel out of sorts.
And you'll start looking for ways that the lion could get out of its cage. Or making them up. Yeah.
And having an unpleasant time. And maybe not even being mindful of where it's coming from, that it might have been 20 years ago that you had the experience with, could even be a past life. We've talked about that before too. And I'm actually hearing more and more and more about this energy that we could be carrying around today from our past experiences. That's a different subject for another time, but back to this idea that in the absence of love, we reach a place that we call fear. Fear doesn't exist. And this is so cool because we even call it false evidence appearing real. So if fear doesn't exist, if what we're afraid of doesn't exist because it isn't actually happening, if it was happening, we'd call it danger. But because it's not happening and it's only going on in our head, it doesn't really exist, which then gets us back to there is only love.
Yep.
But we have to get back to that place.
I talk about that in my book, Fear is an Illusion, actually, extensively, because the point of the book is in recognizing that fear is not organic to the human experience. It's not inherent in the sense that we are not born afraid. We learn how to be afraid, and we learn how to be afraid exactly by what you just described, which is the absence of love. Whether it's the absence that is projected to us or the feeling of it within us still produces the same result. That was all.
Yeah.
But it's such a powerful paradigm and such an important one to understand in Hannah. I like how you're drawing this connection because when you recognize that fear is an illusion, and not just like, oh, woo-woo, fear is an illusion, when you can really get it that you weren't born afraid, you learned how to be afraid, then you know you can unlearn how to be afraid. And that
absolutely
takes back to so many other things we've talked about, shifting state and doing the things that move your vibration back to the love field, because love as an energy, as a vibration has a certain frequency. It's been measured. It's been tested. You know, there are things that stimulate when your field is in a state of love, the vibration is very high. And so there's no room for things like fear and doubt and worry and all the things that you were talking about. And the distinction between this is another key thing is that people go, yeah, but what happened? You know, what about when this happened? And your point is very well taken, which is what you experience is danger if it's real. And that means that it's an imminent threat to your survival, which could or could not be true. But in the case of the lion in the running wild in the zoo, yeah, there's definite potential for you losing your life. But the distinction between danger and fear is huge.
Yeah. Yeah. And even if it wasn't you potentially running the risk of losing your life, because the subconscious, unconscious mind, which we know is at least 82%, maybe as much as 85% of the mind, doesn't differentiate between self and other. So if you see someone else that's in jeopardy of being harmed at the zoo by the wild animal, it's happening to you too in that part of our mind, which again then gets us into the, oh my gosh, I'm vicariously experiencing danger.
Yeah.
Even though I'm probably going to be able to run away, it's as if that part of our mind experienced the same thing as the person that was being mauled.
Well, it comes back to that idea of it isn't, it, it, I don't know. And this would be a very interesting thing to pursue too, is that I don't know that in the space of, especially when you're in a situation like that, in the space of danger, it's we're in danger. What are we going to do about it? Well, part of the problem is we can't do anything about anybody else being in danger. We can only take care of our own. We can only take care of our own. And some people can get past their own danger to be able to intercede where someone else is having danger. Mm-hmm. But in order to do that, the same thing that we continually talk about, you have to be able to shift state. You have to be able to get out of the energy of danger so that you can assist others to get out of danger as well. Because if you're in danger, you're in survival mode. The chances are good you're already in. You know, your system is shutting doorways. You know,
sure. Well, I think of all of the training that I had when I was an aviator in the Marine Corps, and all the simulator flights that I did, and the emergency procedures I had to learn. So what we were really learning how to do is to subdue fear. When an engine would go out, when you'd have a lightning strike, when strange smoke would come out, or you know, all these different things that did and do happen, what we were able to do is tell ourselves, well, wait a second, I have a checklist for this. I don't have to panic, because the mind in panic is not the mind that's going to bring the airplane down safely.
Right.
And not over the top of your house.
So it was just an interesting. I'd be curious what you're, because you kind of just glanced over it, but I think it's really, there could be something very significant there. And that is, what happens? What is it about? How would you define, if it wasn't about having checklists, what is it that, because it's the part of it is the training that gets you to rely on those checklists as fail safes to protect you from danger. Would that be a safe assessment or a safe way to say it?
Sure. And because sometimes they can be pretty lengthy, and in a crisis situation, you can't run the risk of missing one of the checklist items. Some of them were only 4 steps long. Idle boards, brakes. If you got a tire blowout, you go to idle. You put the speed brakes out, you apply the actual mechanical brakes, and put your hook down. That's an easy one for me to remember 20 years later or whatever. Yeah. But some of them for uncontrolled flight were quite lengthy, and you could get 16 out of the steps, but if you miss number 12, you know, that might not be good. So we needed a checklist. What would be interesting is if we had checklists in life. My partner is being rude to me. And it's a 6-item checklist, and we've missed checklist item number 3. I actually
something,
did.
Something had to occur in order for you to be able to shift away from going into fear.
Yes.
Something had to occur before the lists, meaning your consciousness was that knowing that you have the lists gives you a tool.
Right.
It doesn't mean you have to believe the tool works, and it doesn't mean you have to believe that the tool is even valuable. But something in the training says these tools are invaluable to avoiding fear.
Well, yeah, the checklists were created in blood of someone else.
Right. But what happened in your experience that made you confident that you could step away, that you could not go there?
Well, all of it before flight would start out in the simulator, and they had the ability to simulate all of these conditions and shut down different parts of the airplane, or just, and you'd have to go through the checklist, and you'd have an instructor there that would watch you do it and then critique you, and you do that enough to where they are satisfied that if that happened in the air, you would know what to do if that ever happened in the air. And if you fly long enough, it's going to happen in the air. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that's where the real seasoned aviators, they just know that at any given time something could happen, but I've got a lot of experience, and I'm just confident that I can deal with this.
So would you say then that that is that the path to finding that space is through practicing new behaviors, through practicing new perception, through practicing, I mean, because yeah, you're going through, what I'm trying to get at is that there's gotta be a correlation that exists in every situation that's true.
Absolutely.
Right. So there is, the list is not what keeps you from being afraid. The list is a tool that you have that supports you in how to address the danger. What are you doing? How did you get from, what was the process, or what am I looking for here that makes the connection to that? So somehow you had to have built habits that created an environment within your field, within your energy system, that gave you a confidence in what you were doing, and the list support that process, right?
Sure. And part of that process started in the classroom of what page is the checklist on, and even having a test on the electrical system versus the hydraulic system, and knowing where that is in the checklist and being timed to see how fast you could find it, so you're not fumbling around and missing a page or something like that. And then understanding each of the words in the checklist, and then taking all that experience into the simulators. And at some point during the flight, they would go through and they would disable certain parts of the airplane that you'd have to push circuit breakers in, or you'd have to reset this, or you'd have to manually do something that's normally automated. Mm-hmm. And then your confidence level just goes up of, hey, I know what page it's on. I go through the sequence. I know what all of this stuff means. Okay, I push the button in. Now I've done this. It either worked or it didn't work. I go on to the next step. And then at some point, your confidence level is high enough that you're ready to go do it in the real world.
So what's the difference between you and the guy that has the meltdown in the simulator?
Well, if the guy has a meltdown in the simulator enough times, he doesn't go on any farther in the training. There's somebody that makes the call that his brain's just getting hijacked, and he's not able to keep a level of enough head in the heat of the battle. And that's really, it's managing chaos is really what it comes down to, is how well can you manage chaos? And that's what makes a good field general. You know, you got this battalion that just got wiped out, but you got two other regiments backing it up, and you know what your plan is, and you maintain a level head and don't panic. Don't become overcome by fear.
So I'm trying to get you to get to the soft stuff. I'm trying to get you to get.
Okay, you want to take it out of the airplane and back to relationship? We could do that.
We could, but I want to identify it in the context of the example you used, because to me it's important for everyone to recognize, and all the people that are listening to us to recognize that this is not an isolated thing. This exists in every experience that we encounter. This, so
right.
Within the structure of what you were doing, there's something that's more intangible in the sense that it's not a list, it's not a book, it's not a reference. It's something that develops in your field, in your state. Maybe that's the confidence. Maybe it's there's something. And again, I was using the example of the person that melts down. Obviously the person melts down in the simulator, something isn't there, that whatever that something is that I'm trying to identify in an energetic way, in a definitive way that we can all go, what is that thing?
What comes to me, Jim, is a lack of trust, one, mm-hmm. in the simulator.
Good word.
One, in the checklist. I don't trust the checklist. I don't trust that if I follow the checklist, I'm coming home. I'm coming back. I'm going to be able to get through this. It's just a lack of trust. I don't trust the checklist. I don't trust myself to be able to follow through with the checklist. I just don't trust.
So good. That is an absolutely fantastic answer, because that's the intangible thing that exists across everything that we encounter, whether it's a personal relationship, whether it's a dog, whether it's a human, whether it's a car, whether it's it doesn't matter what it is. It's the lack of trust in self, or the abundance of trust in self, that sets the stage in our energy for us to be able to approach danger or go into fear.
Right.
Right. And so
what I can remember my instructors telling us a lot, particularly when you're flying out over the ocean, you're 100 miles, 200 miles offshore. Sometimes the sky and the water look the same. Sometimes you put your head down for a second and you're in a turn and you bring your head back up and you think you're straight and level, but you're still turning and you get this thing called vertigo, mm-hmm. the inner ear cilia not matching up with what's really going on. And what the first step is recognizing that you have vertigo. And the second step is trust your instruments. Your That's instruments right. don't get vertigo.
Right.
You get vertigo, but your instruments don't get vertigo. And I remember having this happen several times. And my brain is telling me I am not in a turn. My airplane tells me I'm in a turn. I've got to trust my instruments. And it's such a weird thing to know that I can't trust myself in this moment. And I've got to go outside myself to trust something else that doesn't get vertigo, that doesn't get influenced the way that the human does.
Well,
and so sometimes.
Go ahead. Sorry. Sometimes
when I'm working with people that lose distortions of reality, I tell them that they have to have somebody in their life that they trust enough that will tell them what's okay and what's not okay. When we lose our way,
ultimately the trust has to be in the process. So mm-hmm. if you've, and this is, and I say this specifically because in this example, but in any example, the trust process is created when you marry what you understand with what you execute, right? So there is trusting in the old adage, trust what you learned, or trust what you know, or trust the training. Mm-hmm. We hear that like ad nauseum and about that kind of stuff. So in the moment that it comes down to it, if you are not trusting the instrumentation, you're ultimately not trusting your perception, because you're believing the perception that's faulty, but you're not believing the other part of that, which is you've been trained to respond. You've not been trained to react. You've been trained to respond.
Mm-hmm.
And,
right.
And so the difference there is that inherent trust in self. And I think it's such a key thing. If we tie back to, as we tie it back to the love piece, you look at the categories, the parental love, the brotherly love, the romance love, the platonic love. It's all degrees of trust. When you categorize people into particular, I love this person because they're my brother. You know, I just as a little side story, I for years had, and still actually kind of hold this, but my father and I didn't speak to each other for 15 years. And we went through, you know, as I was growing up, I didn't really think he liked me all that much. And I don't think he really cared too much about my existence. That was my take of the situation. Wasn't necessarily the reality of the situation, but as I got older, when it came around, because we had gone through a lot. When I came out, it was a rough time, and there was no acceptance there. And then I got sick, and in the course of working through that process, we mended fences, and the family kind of came back together. And then there was another rift, and that one lasted 15 years. So, what I used to say, my mother used to say to me all the time, Jim, take the high road. Jim, take, reach out, talk to your dad, do something, call him, do blah, blah, blah. And I would say, Mom, let me be really clear here. If this person was not my father, I wouldn't pay him any attention at all. He would not be a figure in my life. I don't let people who treat me that way show up in my life. So I don't care that, you know, but it's blood, but it's blood. I'm like, yeah. Please clarify what that has anything to do with. It's still how you treat people. It's still, you know, to this day, I have no idea if he holds an unconditional, I know he doesn't hold an unconditional space for me. I know that. My mother, on the other hand, holds a completely unconditional space for me. And the contrast is very powerful. Now, of course, my dad and I are, you know, still kind of hit and miss, but it's nothing like it was. There's still connection and we do talk. But it's still interesting that my only reason for engaging him is because he's called my dad. Not because I have some deep abiding relationship, not because we've built something that warrants that. He's simply my dad. And by virtue of that, I literally have to think differently in order to do things that are right or appropriate. Because my brain doesn't think that. I don't go that direct. Oh, it's my dad, so forget, and move on. Yeah, I forgave and forgot. It's done. I don't hold any grudges. I don't have any energy about it. But this person is not somebody I would go out of my way to build a relationship with. And we've tried, I don't know, 8 or 10 times over the course of my lifetime so far. And it gets marginally okay, you know. But it's interesting to me because I do not have that experience that I have with Michael, with my father. But I do have that experience closer with my mom. I had it even probably closer with my brothers, although that's a little sticky wicket too. There is an unconditionalness for me. They are, because they're my brothers, I want to attend to them, but they've also attended to me in the course of my life. So there has been a balance that has kind of happened in our world. But as we've gotten older and as we've kind of grown into our own adults, they've done some pretty shitty, stupid things that have affected the engagement within our relationship. So the love is not gone, but the activity of engagement is less, if that makes sense.
Sure.
So it's kind of interesting to think in terms of how you hold love and how you're supposed to think about your parents or your siblings or whatever, in the context of love. And I have to say, I think you can love universally. I think you can, but as far as it'd be interesting to kind of dive into the one-on-one piece of the relationships and love and what that looks
sure.
like.
Well, what I hear you describing is what I find myself talking about as love from a distance or love with boundaries. Mm-hmm. And most importantly, love without expectation and or what we call conditions.
Yes.
So there are aspects of how your father loved you with regard to space in the home that you were raised in.
Absolutely.
Food that you ate. Provisions, but he didn't love with the emotional bonding. He wasn't really a dad. Sounds like he was more of a father that provided the physical things. He did not show up in an emotional way for you, and not much of a spiritual connection there either.
No, he was
so you could love him for being a provider.
Yes,
and you can still have a good life and a great life because you don't need him to love you in what you would have as maybe more of an ideal desire to be loved by a father. It doesn't affect your life because you can either do that for yourself or you can find someone else that will love you in that way that fills that void, if there is a void.
Yeah, no, because there was a huge epiphany that happened for me about, I want to say it was about 7 or 8 years ago, with regard to my dad, and I, something had occurred and I was processing that. And I came to a point where I recognized that I had been kind of demonizing that relationship a little bit too much, and letting it be a source of frustration. And part of that was because I wasn't acknowledging what he did do. And you said it perfectly. I actually wrote him a letter, and I said in this letter, I can only imagine what it must have felt like as a father for your namesake and firstborn child to want to have as little to do with you as possible. I can imagine that felt like hell. You know, I don't know how to address that, but what I do know is that you were always there. You were not an absentee father. You were not that never home guy. You provided me a beautiful home. You provided me all types of things that kept me on the planet, you know, and kept me safe. And I knew that I was okay in that regard. But how important it was to acknowledge what he did do and what a change that made in my attachment to what we were talking about for the conditions, because now I respect what he did and how he did it. I respect that he did the best he could from where he was with what he had. But I am no longer needing or attached to him having to be a specific way for me to be okay. It actually sort of went the other direction, you know, where he has kind of wanted more to find that okayness because he never found it with his parents. And there's another whole history there that's just, you know, that's not pretty and not dealt with. So it's kind of hard to do what you don't deal with, you know? So yeah, we took a quantum turn, but the idea being that I got to move into that more distant, more unconditional space, recognizing that I can show up. I can, you know, like he's going through a bunch of health issues now and, you know, and a stroke and a brain bleed and, you know, different things that have been happening. And I can show up and hold space, and I can show up and be there and fully present with him to provide energy in that space. And then when it's done, it's done. Do you know what I mean? I don't take it home. I don't walk away feeling all of this and that. His process is his process. He's created his life the way he's created his life. That has nothing to do with me. And so it creates a really interesting, a different balance, a different place of perspective, because that unconditionalness is there. You know, if he called and said, "Hey, can you come?" I'd be there, because
sure,
that's kind of what you do. It's interesting, when he got sick, when he went into the hospital, I really struggled, and I'm, you know, it's kind of tough to admit on the airwaves, but the truth of the matter is I had to resource my brothers to find the appropriate response in the situation, because I wasn't in a position that I could just go buy a plane ticket and jump on a plane and go there. I didn't even know that I wanted to, not because I didn't care, but because it didn't seem that he did, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like, what do you do? You know, what do I do here? I think I probably should show up. I should be supportive and make sure he's okay. But the interesting dynamic is my dad got remarried, and his other family is his attention.
Yeah.
So he doesn't really put a lot of attention on us. You know, he doesn't call, he doesn't engage. He doesn't, you know, every now and again, he'll say, "Hey, I'm going to go fishing up in so-and-so somewhere in the back of wherever. Do you want to go?" You know, and sure, if you want to spend $2,500 and go sit on a boat and fly fish for a week, great. Not my thing, but it's not about us. It's about him and him. And he kind of goes, "Well, I should probably see if they want to join me."
You know? Yeah.
But I think he has a different relationship with the three younger brothers than he does with me, which he does, but they all have their own struggles with that relationship. But anyway, the point of the story was to tie to this whole idea of the love is not, it's not just like fear is not something we're born with, just because your birth father or parent is that person, is the person you call dad, doesn't necessarily mean that you have a good space of love or unconditionalness for that relationship.
Yeah. Well, you can love him unconditionally if you understand his limitations.
Yes.
And realize that he's doing the best he can with what he has to work with. It just isn't very much. And you can love him for how he did show up with what he has to work with.
Absolutely. And that soothes my soul. That keeps me in clarity and alignment with the love aspect of myself. That's how I can right. love him. I don't have to love his personality. I don't have to love, you know, the crappy things he's done. I mean, and bear in mind, the guy is not a horrible human being by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, he brought four boys into the world, raised them up. We're all out there being successful. Something had to stick.
Yeah. You know? Well, I'd like to challenge you for a second and say you can actually love him for those things we would call his shadow, because that's his total self. We all have a shadow.
Fair enough.
And if we're willing to love others the way we love ourselves and vice versa, it's a package deal. But you can love with a distance, a safe distance, and you can love with healthy boundaries.
Yep.
So that it's not toxic to you and you're not setting yourself up for disappointment consistently, wanting something from somebody that they don't have to give.
A very good point. And I was having a little minor epiphany there, which was the realization that the unconditionalness, the love that I have for him, is what gets me on a plane.
Yeah. Yeah. And hopefully you did that primarily for you, because it was the right thing for you to do.
Yeah. All the way around.
Whether he wanted you to be there or not.
Absolutely. And that's how I felt about it, actually, because I wasn't sure. You know, we were in the throes of another little ditty, another little issue that he had recently stopped communicating with me. Like this, I mean, it was like a month or a month and a half before he had the brain bleed. And he had found another reason that, you know, not to talk to me or respond to me or return my calls or whatever. And I'm like, okay, well, you know, that was the conundrum that I was in. And it was, well, I can hold a space of love and I can hold a big space of love. And that's what gets me on the plane to go there and to spend time and to be as present and fully available to him as possible. And to walk away when I was done and go, okay, did that. You know? So interesting. So yeah, the love thing within all kinds of context of relationship is it'd be fun to peel that apart a little bit more to understand what it is we think we're defining as love. Because the depth of the experience that I have with the people that I know, like I was saying before, you're comparing Michael and yourself with regard to the love piece. I don't, with the people, because I don't seem to have that differentiation, I'm not sure how you define, and I got to go back and think about in my own life, the different people that I have been connected to or said I loved and they're no longer in my life. And how do I hold them in my consciousness? You know, when I think about those people, and it seems like most of them I can hold in a very positive place. Regardless of what happened, you know, over time, you kind of find it. But what, so I want to see if there's any peeling of that, which is my way of throwing it back to you and saying, any thoughts about
perfect segue here, my friend.
Excuse me.
I actually came prepared to dive into that part.
Oh, right on.
The reference or the source that I would like to use is simply one of many. This is by no means the coup de grace or any of those other words or ways we describe the ultimate. This particular version of what love is and what love isn't many people have heard before. So I'm going to read it through in its entirety, and then I'll go back and we'll take a look at each piece. Have a bunch to chew on as far as your request to peel the onion. Okay, so I hope you have a tissue out. If we're going to peel the onion, we're going to make some eyes water here. Okay, so this starts out, love is patient. Love is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not boast. Love is not proud. Love does not dishonor others. Love is not self-seeking. Love is not easily angered. Love keeps no record of wrongs, does not delight in evil. Love rejoices with the truth. That's an interesting one in light of this podcast. Love always protects. Love always trusts. Love always hopes. Love always perseveres. And love never fails. If people want to know where that came from, came out of the good book, 1 Corinthians 13:4-8, New International Version. So there's
welcome
a lot there.
It. Welcome to Adventures in Truth Podcast Bible Study.
Some might see it that way. But like I said, you know, that's something I've been sharing with people for years. And the reason is I kind of haven't found anything better.
Well, so can I jump on it? Does it bounce?
Absolutely. Now,
here's what stuck out to me. And it got there at the end. Everything you described, every sentence says, does not, does not, does not. And
well, there were half of them were do nots.
Except
half of them were do nots.
But I find that interesting because why is it that love can only be defined by what it's not?
Well, if we read it again, there were half that were nots and half that were. And to prepare for that, I actually wrote the opposite. So now we get to go through the opposites, all right? So I think this will give us a better description by looking at what it is, what it isn't, and the opposites of those things. For example, the very first one was love is patient. So the opposite of patient would be impatient. And you could rate that on a scale of how patient are you and what is the definition of time regarding patience. Is it a day, a week, a month, a year, a decade? Well, so if we're operating in an attitude of impatience, that's not love. If we're being patient with the person, giving them time, giving them their process, giving them their space, that would be a way to be able to say, am I resonating in an energy of love here with regard to patience? I don't need you to change today. Sometime this decade would be nice. And actually, I don't need you to change at all, but to be in relationship with you in a close way, in a close,
completely out of love.
Yeah, if I want a close, unlimited relationship with you, then it can't be toxic. And if there is toxicity showing up, then I need to be patient for that to at some point be addressed so that I can have smaller boundaries with you. I don't need these big, huge, big boundaries to keep us apart so that we're not hurting each other. So any thoughts about patient versus impatient as a continuum within, there were probably like 20 of these ways of describing love. Remember, we started out with our podcast tonight about 32 different words to describe snow in the Eskimo experience. So now we have 19 ways. We're just talking about way number one. Subcategories of love.
I'm struck when you were talking about patience. The things that were going through my head was love is allowing, love is accepting, love is not judgmental.
Right.
And I'm thinking in terms of what you were, you know, love is patient. those are all, well, going from allowing, acceptance, non-judgmental, those are, allowing is a state, is choosing to, like, patience. I don't think patience is an attribute. I don't think allowing is an attribute. So when they become attributes, what it gets muddy to me. It gets a little muddy when it's about behaviors being defined as loving or non-loving, because it really depends on the state. It depends on the motivation, but we can keep going. I want to see where this is.
Okay.
Where this is evolving.
So the next one was kind. And of course the opposite would be unkind. I don't think we need to go into that. It's a pretty straightforward, simple word. We know what kindness is. We know what unkindness is. The next one was described as, this is where the first not showed up, envious. Another word of that for that would be jealous. So the opposite of envy and jealous would be something like supportive or happy for the success of others or the situation for others.
Mm-hmm.
The next one down would be another not, and it was boastful. Another word for that would be bragging, braggadocious. So I didn't really know what the opposite of boast or brag was, so I just wrote down straightforward, because it wouldn't be minimizing. It would be what's in between minimizing and boasting. No. Would just be it is.
Boasting is false confidence, so the other side is confident. Boasting and bragging come from a space of feeling inferior and feeling not good enough. So that
confident, straightforward. Yep. So then the next one down was another not, which was proud. The opposite of proud would be humble. So love is humble. It's confident. It's happy for others' successes. It's kind. It's patient. That's what we're working on so far. The next one down was also a not that said not, love does not dishonor. So the opposite of dishonor would be honor. It's honorable. You would talk about others in an honorable way and talk to each other in an honorable way. And then we get into some heavy hitters. This one to me is one of the most important that's on the list. And it was a not. It's not self-seeking. It doesn't seek its own way. It doesn't have to have what it wants. And the opposite of that is what you were talking about a minute ago, which is what we call accepting. I can accept the way this person is showing up. I just might need a good boundary that I don't get barfed on emotionally. I don't get that it's not that the toxins coming from this, if there are toxins, really are not, they don't have anything to do with me. It's that person's issues, that person's stuff. Most, and we call that condition. So if somebody is,
what was the front of that? What was the,
what did you say? I'll read it straight.
Not about self or not about.
Love is not self-seeking. Love is not self-seeking, which to me means love doesn't demand that it has its own way, that it has to be my way, or that I need you to be a certain way. I'm not seeking anything for you to be a certain way so that it pleases me. That's to me what self-seeking is. It's about you, but it really is about me. What you're doing either works for me or it doesn't work for me. I need you to be a certain way. That's all self-seeking. That's conditional. That's another way of saying conditional love, if it's self-seeking.
It's an interesting way that you define it, because self-seeking typically is about me first.
It's the same thing. I'm saying the same thing.
Is. Oh, no, you're not.
But if it's me first, that means I need you to show up in a way that's pleasing me first. And I need you to be the way it's got to work for me. It's me first. Like, you know, yeah, why is the way
self-serving really doesn't include anybody else.
why is your
where I was disconnecting from it, because self-serving is about you don't matter, I matter.
Yeah,
so you're not even in my equation. This is about me, you know.
Yeah. So this would be about conditional love. That was what we're talking about here. I will love you as long as you meet these conditions.
Exactly.
Which is the opposite of accepting, and it does not include the person's light and their shadow.
Their wholeness. Yeah.
I accept your light. I do not accept your dark. And Alanis Morissette has a great song about that called Everything. Mm-hmm. People want to check that out. It's an awesome song. I love your everything. And hardly any of us know how to do that. Yeah. That's going to be in the summary, by the way. The next one down is love is not easily angered. So to me, the opposite of that would be temperance, slow to anger, slow to wrath. Next one down was love keeps no record of wrongs. It's not into score keeping. So the opposite, of course, would be keeping score. You did this to me, so I'm going to bank that, and it's going to come back at you. The next argument we have.
Wait a minute. So there you go. You didn't get the opposite there. They said love does not keep score.
Yeah. So the opposite would be keeping score.
Okay.
Next one down is love does not delight in evil. And I was trying to, that word doesn't really work for me so much anymore, this whole idea of evil. So I substituted love does not delight in being selfish. So you have the idea of selfless versus selfish. So if you're not delighting in practicing evil, then the opposite would be delighting in practicing evil. And to me, that's just simply means selfishness, a high degree of selfishness. So love would be selfless. Out of love would be, or anything less than love, a lesser amount of love would be selfishness. We have about six more to go.
Okay.
You hanging in there with me?
I am. I'm making a list and I'm checking them twice.
Okay, Santa. So love rejoices with the truth. The opposite of that would be practicing deceptions or lies. And then we have a list of always. Always protects. The opposite would be unprotective. Always trusts. The opposite would be untrusting or distrusting. Always hopes. The opposite would be hopeless. Always perseveres.
Those three are pretty useless, quite frankly. Trust is good. The other two are Bible.
Protects. That love protects.
Yeah.
Well, isn't that where we get the idea that, man, I'd take a bullet for you?
Yeah. Notice the eye roll. Sorry, so you were at trust?
That's some of the mama bear stuff.
You know, no, I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I'm just saying that it doesn't necessarily belong here. That's Bible stuff. That's Jeebus stuff to me. I'll get more into that after you finish, because that's why I'm making my list.
Okay. We have always hopes as opposed to hopeless. Always perseveres as opposed to easily swayed. Never fails as opposed to quits. So I'd like to read it through in its entirety now, focused on the what I would call the positive side and leaving out the nots. So in this list, you'd have love is patient, love is kind, love is happy for the other's success, love is confident and straightforward, it's humble, it honors, it's accepting of both light and shadow, it's tempered, keeps no record of wrongs, it's selfless, rejoices with the truth, protects, trusts, hopes, perseveres, and never fails. On the opposite side of the not love, you have impatient, unkind, jealous, boastful, proud, dishonor, seeking its own way, easily angered, keeping score, selfishness, deception and lies, unprotective, untrusting, hopeless, easily swayed, and quits. And?
Very interesting. It was especially interesting listening to it in that direction because, so what I did is as you were talking, I made two lists. One was a list of behavior. The other was a list of states. because I think they're the, if the expression of love was on a scale, I would say that that expression of love was like at 15 to 20% of 100% in the scale of what's potential for love. And that's where most of us are trained to live is in that 20% or less. Meaning if I can behavior mod my way to it, then I'm good. So if I look for those things that I shouldn't do, then I can stop doing them and then I'll be more in love. I'll be more in a love place. Yes and no, from my perspective. So the things I wrote, acceptance, non-judgment, confidence, humility, trust, those are all, actually humility doesn't go along there. Humble, kind of, I'm on the fence on that one. I think that has been so contrived that it's and used so inappropriately to make people feel less than rather than feel empowered. Humble is a very powerful place to be, but it's not humiliating and it's not humiliated. It's just simply a state of I'm a part of greater things.
Yeah.
Therefore, being a part of greater things, I contribute to greater things. And I, you know, and then the other words on the other list were the behavior stuff, the kind, the patient, the honorable, the temperate, the selfless, the positive. Those are all non-state, manage my behavior and my emotion kind of experience. But it's so powerful because it's exactly the dichotomy that we live in. Is if I can manage this list of behaviors, then I'll get where I need to go. Well, you do, but you only get to that 20% max place because you're not in state. You're not in a place or in the experience of love because the energy of love permeates. The energy of love is an experience. It's not a word. It's not a defined behavior. And you can do any behavior through the experience of love and it will change that behavior if you allow yourself that space to do that. So aiming toward the allowing takes care of most of everything on the list, on the other list, on the behavior list, because the allowing says, I'm allowing the world to be what the world is. I don't have any judgment. I'm non-judgmental about how the world is. I'm just observing and I'm participating and I'm doing what I can, bringing this energy of love into the space, into my world, so that it influences everything that I do and informs everything that I do. And that happens through learning the trust and the confidence in self, the acceptance of self, the allowing of self to be okay. But if you're looking at the other list, oh, I'm not kind enough, I'm not patient enough, I'm not honorable enough, I'm not temperate enough. People spend their entire lives beating themselves up over these stupid words when really what they need is to find a state that supports who they are. And part of that is, mm-hmm. is finding that space of acceptance and allowing for who I am, unencumbered by what everybody else has tried to tell me about who I am. And because our world is sort of focused on this idea of we learn who we are because people tell us who we are. And then we figure out that once, you know, they tell us we're this long enough, then we begin to believe it. And then later in life, we figure out how to undo that because it was never true to begin with. You know? And it just right. becomes this vicious cycle. So the key things are finding the states and finding the way to be in state with that energy and building and building and building that vibration, because kindness and patience and honorability and temperance and selflessness and positivity. I actually wonder, you know, when people try to describe, say, somebody who is a yogi or some master who has been through, you know, many levels of transformation and all such things. When we go to try to describe their presence, there's a point in one part of the journey where you would go, gosh, he was such a nice person. He was so patient with me. And then once you begin to understand it, you go over to the other side and you go, the energy in his space is so powerful. It doesn't become about focusing on behaviors. It becomes about the state of the energy that you're experiencing from that human being.
And these words would be ways of describing what you're talking about the experience is.
Yes, but even the choice of words would change when you were being in the experience of and not trying to define mm-hmm. the behaviors. Because if you asked them and said, do you think you're kind and patient? And, you know, they'd probably laugh at you because it's not something you think about. Because when you operate from the state of love, you don't think about being kind. It's just, it's part of how you be in love. You don't want to, you know, I think I've shared this with you before with one of the sort of bedrock things for me in my relationship with Michael is that I never want to see his pain or I would never want to see my pain in his eyes. So what does that mean? That means if I can see pain in his eyes from my action, I'm not in love. I'm not being in love. I am somehow inflicting behavior, but being able to see my pain in his eyes means I'm not there. And so that means step back. That means whoop, time out, because that's to me is not acceptable anymore that ever come as a part of the relationship, regardless of the state of the relationship, you know? Mm-hmm. I think the same would be, I could say the same was true even since we were talking about my father, that the same would be true. I don't ever want to see my pain in his eyes. The question becomes if there ever was a point that his pain or my pain was in his eyes and I never saw it. You know what I mean? I at that point couldn't acknowledge it. And I think that coming back to that letter that I said that, you know, that I did write to him and acknowledging what he did do for me and that he was a provider and he was there and he was always there, you know, was the way to deal with that, because that was my recognition of my pain in his eyes. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yep.
And I love that expression because it to me speaks volumes to, it's a great way to assess a relationship, every relationship, you know, because the love is a constant and an experience, you can look at all the people in your life and you can, you know, if there's a point that they don't have that reflection back to you, it gives you the opportunity to go, wow, somewhere I wasn't in love with this relationship in this relationship. Is there a way to correct that? Is there a way to amend that? Is there a way to, that I can bring my love back to this relationship, even though we may not be close anymore, or we may not have any connection like we did, can I hold that big enough space? And the answer is yes, we all can.
Nicely stated. Good stuff.
Yeah.
I was wondering, as you were talking about being in the presence of a yogi or somebody who's mastered the art of living in the energy of love, if we might use words like radiant, mm-hmm. Enlightened, delightful, joyous.
All great words.
Yeah.
But yeah, reflective of state, which is very cool.
When the Dalai Lama came here within the last 10 years, I can't remember exactly when that was. It was a really big deal. And I knew people that paid large sums of money to go see him speak. And what everybody told me was he didn't say anything. He just stood up there and laughed. They were disappointed. That's wanted fantastic. To hear a speech. They wanted to hear, you know, they wanted their left brain to get stimulated with some enlightened wisdom or something. And but he just stood up there and smiled and laughed.
And it just makes my heart sing. Makes me want to laugh, actually, because it's that's so perfectly exemplifies exactly what I was talking about. Is it's
and what I was thinking was, he's like, these people are paying $400 to be here in these seats, and isn't that funny? And I'm just going to laugh.
Oh, my goodness. And that makes that actually that observation or the potential of that observation actually to me brings another level of this is that understanding that love, the thing that's so cool about the experience of love is that it is what it is. Like that thought could have gone through his head and may have gone through his head because he's a human being and that's right. What we do, right?
Yep.
Question is, how did he use that energy in support of love? Did it go to upliftment or did it go to downward pushing energy away? No, he just went, isn't this the funniest thing ever? Because it is. You know, all of these, you know, hundreds of people wanting to spend hundreds of dollars for me to say something that they think is going to change their life, and they're missing the point completely. Because if you'd sit here and laugh with me, your life would change instantly.
Right.
Because you would feel the state of love that I'm touching in this room right now.
Yes. Yep.
And it can do nothing but completely alter who you are. It gives me goosebumps. I mean, I love that kind of stuff. It's so amazing. I'm sitting here with them all on my arms and legs. That's the best. So I think it's, you know, I am feeling this pull to sort of ground it out a little bit in that we're having a very deep kind of complex conversation about the experience of love, but I want to make sure that the listeners are understanding that coming to that space is an evolution. And part of that evolution is recognition. And part of that recognition is being able to identify within ourselves one-on-one with who we are, to be able to assess where am I in state with myself? And what what can I do today to alter that state? It doesn't have to be a big, gigantic step. It's just a question of, am I trying to manage behavior or am I trying to achieve a new state? Am I trying to change emotions and thoughts or am I looking at cultivating a state of energy that supports me completely? Because that double-edged sword thing, you know, that if you can get there from here, then all the things that you think you have to work on go away because your vibration is no longer in that place of brokenness. So then the only things you got to tend to are things that might be in the way of or in some way restricting the flow of that love through your vibration. And then because you're already in that space, you can sit back and go, oh, okay, well, and you're still going to have those moments where you're like, you're still going to have those moments when you go, it happens. We're human. The trick is you see it, you experience it, and then you shift it. Then you go somewhere else.
Sure.
You don't go down the rabbit hole. So, and the rabbit hole is, oh, I feel this. It must be important in the sense that what I'm feeling matters, as opposed to what I'm feeling is my indication of how close or far away from the love experience I am.
Sure. Is this a loving question? Okay. I'm not getting what I need from this relationship. Is that question coming from a state of love. This relationship isn't giving me what I need. Is that coming from a state of love? Because I hear that a lot.
I think that there is a, there is a, how it shows up for me, and I'm trying to find the words to make sure I'm giving the right definitions. When you're in a relationship, if you're in the space of love within the context of the relationship, meaning you're holding that space, you have that energy about you, it's you're comfortable in it at whatever percentage you're comfortable in it. If the individual that you are in relationship with is not able to match the vibration that you bring, there is an acknowledgement of that when you go, I'm showing up and we're doing this. And
yeah,
we're doing this
in dissonance rather than resonance.
Yes. So there is a lack of resonance. Acknowledging that lack of resonance can absolutely be in a space of love. The trick is not to go into judgment and blame about that, because my energy and your energy are both contributing. Well, we're contributing in the sense that, okay, maybe my vibration is here and your vibration, and I'm doing this on a up and down scale, which probably isn't fair. Because it kind of limits the experience. But I think you can absolutely be in a space of love and acknowledge that we are not in resonance. But the trick is how much of that is behavior driven, how much of it is energy driven. How much of it is you're not going to change enough for me to want to love you the way I think that we can do this. You know, I'm loving from this place. And you can't meet me there. That's judgment.
Right.
Yeah. So did that answer your question?
Did. Yep.
Do you have a different perspective of that or another perspective of that?
Well, I like the question by itself. When someone makes a statement, I'm not getting what I want from this relationship, to me, puts it into that category of self-seeking.
Yes.
And it's not a question that comes from a place of love. Place of love might explore that more along the lines of, why are we not resonating in the way that we can? Or what work do we need to do to get to a place where we can be resonating closer to where it feels more playful? It feels more life-giving rather than life-sucking.
Say the question again.
Well, the original question, I think, was something like, I'm not getting what I want from this relationship. And if you're operating from that mindset, you're done. You're not going to.
Well, and I think that the important thing there is also in recognizing that that's another place that you have to kind of turn the mirror back around.
Exactly.
I'm not contributing to this relationship and I'm satisfied.
Yes.
That's the actual statement. That's the reality of it in most cases. It's just, oh, you're not giving me what I need, meaning, so this is that you complete me nonsense.
Right. Thank you for bringing that up.
You know, no, you
can
don't.
Can you say that again? I'm sorry. I didn't hear you. Can you say that again?
You don't complete me.
Oh, wait a minute. I thought you were my soulmate, my one and only that I've been searching for lifetimes to find, to complete me.
Honey, you're reading all the wrong books.
Dashing my dreams.
No, but you know, it's a very real thing, and it's unfortunate I come back to this frequently sometimes, is that it's of detriment to the metaphysical community in that regard too, because it becomes, you know, spiritual punishment, you know, or a spiritual metaphysical thing. And it's not, it's still got to come back to, what am I bringing to the table? You know, am I satisfied with what I'm bringing to the table? Because if I am, then right. I'm going to be in a state of love. And if I'm in a state of love, then I'm going to go, yeah, this is an imbalance. It's not about you suck and you're no good. It's, this is an imbalance and it doesn't feel good. It's, we're not, because of what's happening, it's not uplifting. So is there a way that I can, am I feeding myself? Am I feeding myself enough in my practice, in my work, in what I'm doing to forward my own life, that I have something to give? How many times how many relationships I'm sure have come through your office that you went, what are you people doing in relationship? Neither of you is healthy enough to be trying to carry anybody, you know, or balanced or anything. You're so lopsided that go home, work on yourself for a year, and then let's talk about relationship.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Or relationship, I should say, go home and work on the relationship with self, and then a year we'll work on the relationship with other. Because you have no context with which to have a relationship when you don't have a relationship, a healthy relationship with self. There's no context for how to have a relationship. And the only context you have is living out the examples that you grew up with. Whether you like it or not, it's exactly what we do.
Yeah.
You learn by the time you're three what it is to be in relationship.
Right.
Based on what you see and what you feel in the experience of the people you call your parents. And, you know, it's so amazing to me. You know, I was having a conversation with a guy, and we're going to talk about winter for a second. So I've always kind of been baffled by people who live in Wisconsin and Chicago and Illinois and, you know, up in that neck of the woods at wintertime. It always blows my mind why they stay there. Like, why would you go through this every single year? You know, 37 inches of snow that sits there for four freaking months. Why would you go through that, you know? And I was talking to a guy who lived 2 hours north of Madison, like up in the hinterlands of Wisconsin somewhere. Takes him 2 hours to get to the airport, right? And he lives in the middle of nothing, but that's winter. You know, winter is like up to here. And I said, I've been dying to ask somebody this question. Why do you do that? Why do you stay there? And he looked at me kind of funny and he was like, I don't know that there's anything wrong with it. It's where I've lived there my whole life.
Right.
And I went, oh my God. It blew me away because I didn't realize that I was thinking from my perspective and not their perspective. And right. Their perspective is, this is perfectly normal. This is, there's nothing sure. wrong with this.
What would I compare it to?
Yeah. And the reason for that comparison was the same thing with being in a relationship and being in, you know, the love concept is, you're judging outside of self. You're judging something that you have no experience with. You know, you're trying to come together with someone that you don't know or that you're learning about, that you feel things that you don't understand, you know, and they stimulate all this stuff. But sort of like going back to the beginning, we were talking about danger. You know, that's the time when you have to like go, okay, let's level the playing field here. Let's find that place in myself where what's normal for me is not normal for somebody else. And so tying it back to the family thing, you know, a person who grows up with parents that were less than favorable think that's normal. That's their benchmark for normal in relationships. So that's what they recreate because that's what relationships are until they learn more about what relationships are. Till they try it through, and some never get out of it. Some stay living in the experience of their parents' relationship for their whole life. And maybe it wasn't their parents. It could have been the mom who was a single mom who blah, blah, blah. But the point being that the baseline that you operate from, all of us, every human being, is that core relationship that started your life. Regardless if it was good or bad, it didn't matter. It was yours. There was no good or bad. It's what is. Just like the snow right. in Wisconsin is what is. You know?
Yep.
It's a what is thing. So that's
and I can love it.
Yeah, and that's why it's so important to me that you have to start with your understanding of what you think relationship is within yourself. Then you can take that out into the world and see if you can find someone that you can spend time with or get to connect with that has a similar understanding of their self, because then you can create that space of unconditionalness, because you don't need one or the other person to be different than who they are to share an experience with them. And their desire to change comes organically through their experience, because the love energy illuminates those things that could potentially not serve in moving mm-hmm. forward. Those are the things you attend to, but you do them because they come through you, not because somebody's throwing sticks at you. You know what I mean? And you could get there that way too, but it's a lot less painful if you don't have to have sticks thrown at you. So I got a little long-winded.
Yeah. When we were talking about that question, I'm not getting what I want from this relationship, or you're not giving me what I need from this relationship, those different mindsets. There's a kind of a parable, proverb sort of thing, that if you want something, first give it away. And I think that's what you were driving toward when you said, look in the mirror. Mm. And if something's not showing up for you, what's your part in that?
Yep.
And if, again, it's kind of like the concept is priming the pump. So if you want your partner to be more X, Y, and Z, give away X, Y, and Z and show the example, and it will come back to you. If you want something, you give a piece of it away first and it'll come back.
Yeah. I'm also struck that another, I think, important part that we were talking about, and particularly in romantic relationships, or I'm going to say something bold. Sex and love have nothing to do with each other. Nothing. Yeah. Let me try that word one more time. Nothing to do with each other. You can screw whoever you want, whenever you want. You don't have to love them. You can like them. You can like what they look like, whatever. Can you use that connection to more deeply expand the love experience? Absolutely. But they are not the same, and they are not connected, contrary to what we are taught through most
True.
Of our lives.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's so important, because people think, and I think this is a chronic problem, people get into relationships because they want to get laid. Truly. They just want to they want to have sex, but they can't have sex because religion says that's a bad thing and God's going to smite me and I'm going to go to hell. And, you know, all of the nonsense that gets drummed into us about what that means, as opposed to, I have a need, I have a desire, I have a want. You know, I want to, you know, there's the desire for the sex to release energy. And then there's the desire for sex for the purpose of procreation. And there's a desire for sex in order to find balance, some balance, you know, males and females, male, whatever. It's the use of sex is the use of energy to find a new state of balance in your energy system. It's a way to move energy that is unique to, you know, is a unique way of doing it, but it's not, and then it can be a part of love, but it is not love. And we could probably dive into that a lot, but I think it's important to recognize so that as you move into understanding self better, understanding that urges and desires, that's part of it, is you know, taking that all apart and finding out what you have attached to all of that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. So people get this. Sex is not love any more than a back scratch is love, any more than a handshake is love, any more than a massage is love.
That's good. That's good.
But so, it can be, and love yes. making, love, the elements of love making generally involve commitment. They generally involve a deep level of emotional connection. It generally involves a mutual understanding of what you like, what I like, and how we're going to dance and play together. It has an aspect of playfulness to it. Mm-hmm. The deep, deep soul level, it involves soul work, the whole lovemaking thing. And it can be sexy and fun and erotic too. It can be all of that.
And you don't have to have a relationship to have that. You can create that energy and you can enjoy it, and you don't have to be married to the person forever to do that. And you may want to, because the energy that you create together is so powerful and so uplifting that you want to continue to create that as often as possible.
Right. Right.
But there is a point in every relationship where the sex becomes less important.
Right. You know,
it becomes less impactful in that regard. So it's,
So I'd like to, there were two extra words on that list of 19 that we came up with earlier that I've added to. One would be playful and the other one would be intimate.
Hmm.
And intimate, oftentimes people think of sex and intimacy as the same thing, and they're really not. Just like you very clearly articulated a moment ago, that a great definition I like to use for intimacy is the willingness to be known and the vulnerability that another has to let you know them at their deepest levels. That's intimacy.
It's just it's a greater form of trust.
And oftentimes we think that when we have our clothes off, we're vulnerable. Therefore, being with each other with our clothes off and bumping body parts together makes us intimate, when it really doesn't.
No.
That part alone doesn't.
Yeah.
Intimacy is me really getting to know you. I think the F word that we use used to stand for, it was a crime once upon a time called for unlawful carnal knowledge. If it's an acronym, F-U-C-K stands for unlawful carnal knowledge. And it was to be with someone sexually without having a commitment to them under the institution of marriage.
Did you just make that up?
What's that?
Did you just make that up?
I did not. You've never heard that. You've never heard that before.
Never heard that before.
You know?
Wow.
Yeah. Honestly, I think it's a Van Halen album cover or something like that. Yeah, it's, no, I didn't make it up.
Van Halen album cover. That's awesome.
Yeah. So we say, biblically, to know somebody, they used it as you uncovered their nakedness, or you knew them intimately with regard to sexually, but that it's all just twisted up. And
yeah,
what we're trying to do right now is untwist it.
Which ultimately leads to freedom, which ultimately leads to love. When you have that within in self, we are at about that juncture in the road when it's time to bring it home.
Right on, man. You got any thoughts regarding a summary of where we've been in our adventure today?
Sure. So our desire today was to look at the experience of love, to kind of bring some clarity to the many definitions that we have about love. We likened it to the Eskimos having, 40 different words for the word snow, or for what happens as a result of that. And recognizing how important it is to start with the relationship with self, and to find that space of love within self, and then begin to grow that so that that can be shared. So that that's ultimately what we all want to do. We want to connect at love. We want to connect in a way that uplifts us and moves us to different places and brings us to experiences that we haven't had. The challenge is we get stuck in behavior modification. We get stuck in identifying traits as ways of understanding what love is, instead of finding the experience within ourselves and looking into that. Do I allow myself to be who I am? Do I accept all of who I am? Do I accept that, sometimes I'm a jerk and sometimes I'm an awesome person, but I accept all of it because it's who I am. When I engage with other people, when I'm walking through my life, how much judgment do I carry about all of that? We all carry a ton of it. We're trained into it. Everything we deal with is trained into assessing the goodness or the badness of something, the up or the down of something, rather than just accepting what it is and saying, okay, this is what it is. Is this something that I can work with? Is this something that serves? Is it something that's going to uplift and grow with me? That confidence that I am awesome, and I want my awesomeness to be out there in the world and to share it and I trust that when I share my awesomeness, other people experience that. And so this process of kind of unraveling, you know, we talked a little bit about that intangible thing that keeps us out of danger. We were talking about danger early on as the opposite end of the non-love spectrum, and how important it is to recognize the inordinate amount of trust it takes to be able to execute. And that trust is trust of self first. Mm-hmm. If it's not trust of self first, it will fail you almost every single time, because at some point it will you will test yourself against the outside influence and you'll lose. And that's where you'll learn, you know? And so it's so extraordinary. We have learned so many things about love that aren't true, and that don't serve our truth. And so, hopefully today we've been able to unravel some of that, you know, peeling back some of it so we can see what all of us go through, what I know I've been through, you know, as I talked about my relationship with my dad and, you know, I went had different things with my ex-wife and, you know, all I can go through every relationship and find the places that I didn't show up as well as I thought I could, for myself or for them, you know, and so it's an extraordinary thing to be able to take the time with yourself to understand how that energy feels in your experience. Because once you taste it, you won't want anything else. You'll get to that other stuff and kind of go, oh, what am I doing here? I want to go over there. You know,
right.
You'll train like training in the simulator. You'll train yourself into new behavior and you'll train yourself into new ways of being that allow that space to unfold for you. So that's my sort of recap. If you want to add anything there that I missed, sir, please feel free.
You know, we were discussing some of the elements of love in the very beginning and categories. And I like that we got to the conditional versus unconditional. Very, very important. And another way that we illustrated that was there is only love. In the absence of love, you get to a place of fear. Fear is not real. So that allows us to go back to there is only love. Then we went through 20-something different additional elements of love. We never did get around to love languages, which we can talk about in another podcast or review from a previous one that we've done. But ultimately, I like where Jim landed in his summary, that all of this has to start with self, and that we can only love another to the degree that we can love ourselves, and we can only be loved by another to the degree that we can allow ourselves to love ourselves. That's it. It has to start with self. And what I've found is most of us run around trying to get love poured into us externally, and it just runs out at the level that we can love ourselves.
Yeah.
And so we keep running to someone else. Like, if I can only love myself this much, it doesn't matter how much I pour into the cup. It's going to come to here and run out. There's like a hole right there and it just runs out. So I get some more poured into me. I get some more poured into me and it just runs out until I patch that hole and bring my self-love up to this level. All this is still potential to get, but you can really only experience it to the level that we can do it for ourselves.
Yeah. Awesome. 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 Great topic, my friend. Thank you.
Yeah. Good adventure. Love, it's a wild topic. I found that it was interesting that we got darn near to the end before you brought love and lovemaking and sex into it. It's like, wow, we almost had a whole podcast about love without talking about the sex part of it, the Eros part of it, that element. Yeah.
That's why I kind of make notes when we're talking sometimes, because I hit keywords and I want to remember to go back to them or remember them so we can.
You're good at that. I appreciate that.
Up with us, so. Another great adventure, yes, love these conversations. I just more and more super excited to be here, and I hope everybody out there in podcast land has enjoyed our podcast today. And please feel free to enjoy all of them. Lots of good conversation and stuff going on there, and hopefully it's touching you in ways that helps you to step more fully into who you are, which is
right on.
So. Thanks all for joining us. Have an amazing evening, afternoon, or morning, wherever you are. And we'll look forward to seeing you next week.
Right on. Good night, everybody.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Adventures in Truth Podcast. If you would like to listen to more or to explore all our offerings, visit us on the web at www.adventuresintruthpodcast.com. We also offer video versions of our podcast. Visit our page on YouTube at Adventures in Truth Podcast. We would love to hear from you. Like, connect, and follow with us on Facebook. Want to book us for your next podcast or to speak at your event? Head over to our webpage at www.adventuresintruthpodcast.com at the bottom of the page and send us a note. Thank you so much for listening. We look forward to seeing you again at Adventures in Truth Podcast.